Yesterday, we talked extensively with Jerry Van Dyke, the CBS News reporter who got kidnapped by the Taliban in February of 2008 and was held hostage for 45 days and has written a terrific book about it called Captive. When I booked him on the show, we did it a couple of weeks ago, and I didn't know at the time that WikiLeaks was going to come out with the 90,000-plus leaked documents about the war in Afghanistan, but it gave me a great chance to talk to Jerry about that because he's been covering Afghanistan for decades, is an expert on that country and its neighbor Pakistan, particularly what the inside of a prison cell there looks like, but also about policies and Osama bin Laden and the Pakistani intelligence service and whether they are in fact backing the insurgency and the Taliban inside Afghanistan. If you missed that conversation, and he had some stunning revelations in that interview, you can find it on harrisonline.com. But I was thinking as I went home yesterday that all of this talk about Afghanistan and Pakistan, because of the WikiLeaks story, is at the very least reminding Americans that we're still at war. The longest war in America's history. This fall will mark 9 years since we sent forces into Afghanistan. And it's going to be a lot more years before all of our forces are out of there. President Obama has set next summer as a semi-deadline for when our men and women in uniform will start coming home, but that's only the beginning of the withdrawal. The end of the withdrawal, no one has set a date for that, and it's way, way off in the future. And yet we have members of the military who want to come home. And I'm not just talking about people who are there for their first time or their second time or their third or fourth tour. Even in an all-volunteer army, we still have conscientious objectors. Now, that had a connotation that was very different from today, back in the era when we had a draft, up until the mid-70s, in the Vietnam era. One of the things that split this nation apart was the fact that the government could tell a young man, there were no women being drafted at the time, but a young man of 18 or 19 or 20 years old, we don't care what you're doing in your life, you're going to Southeast Asia, you're going to wear a uniform, carry a gun, kill or be killed. We had a lot of guys who didn't want to go off to war and were able to claim conscientious objector status. A lot of them used that as an excuse for not going, regardless of what they really believed, but a lot of them truly felt that way about war, that there was no such thing as the necessity of war, and they didn't want to go fight anywhere. My next guest helped to counsel some of those 70s members of the military and continues to do so today when conscientious objector is beginning to take on a different and perhaps odd form. Bill Galvin of the GI Rights Hotline joins me here on the Big 550 KTRS. Hi, Bill. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing?
Good. Have I set the history pretty well there?
Yeah, pretty good. Yeah.
You actually were a counselor in the early 70s, and you're now, I understand, in the process of authoring a guide to conscientious objector status in today's military, right?
Yes.
Okay. So before we get into the issue of gays in the military, which is one of the things that is changing that, tell me why somebody in 2010 in an all-volunteer force, nobody made them go, why they would choose to try to be a conscientious objector to get out of their service?
Well, okay, first of all, when people join the military, yes, there's a war going on and people are aware of that, but that's not what is first and foremost in people's minds when they join. Recruiters are really good at deflecting your attention from that and getting you to think about other things like money for college or technical training, things like that. But even so, you know that it's about war probably, and probably in the back of your mind, you know, you might be faced with it, and you might even think, in the abstract, sure, I would defend my country, I would fight for my country. That's a bit different from looking down the barrel of a gun at a live human being and realizing I've got that person's life in my hands.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually where it happens for a lot of people, is right on the battlefield when they are faced with that, or even when they kill people. Sometimes it happens in training, because part of the training is to you know, break down who you are and remake you into somebody who will kill on command. And part of that is a very, you know, brutal kind of, you know, getting rah-rah, all excited about killing and blood and chanting things like, blood makes the grass grow. And that's part of what makes people into soldiers and Marines. But there are some people who react very negatively to it and say, this is nuts. I can't do this. It's wrong.
These are people who find out after they are exposed to it that they're not cut out to be a soldier.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. So when they decide that, what is the path to removing themselves from the military currently?
Okay, well, first of all, let me just say that there are a number of ways out of the military early, you know, all sorts of things, medical problems, hardships, you know, a number of things. Conscientious objection is not an easy way out. But there is a process that's written into the regulations. You submit a written application. It's got 20-some questions on it. Most of them aren't that relevant, things like every place you ever lived, every job you ever had. But there's about 6 questions that get to the heart of what do you believe. And they're questions about, you know, what do you believe, how do these beliefs develop, when did you realize you couldn't be in the military anymore, how do these beliefs influence your life. And so you have to answer these questions, they're like essay questions, and then you submit that, and then you have a series of interviews with a psychiatrist, with a military chaplain, and then with an investigating officer. The investigating officer then writes up a report and a recommendation as to whether or not you get approved, and then it goes all the way up the chain of the command and actually gets decided at the highest level. It's at the Department of the Army, the Department of the Navy. At the secretarial level, there is a CO review board that makes the final decision.
And how long does that take from the moment the person has first applied for conscientious objector status to the time when a decision is made at that top level about their status?
It could be a long time. I mean, it's taken as short as a few months, but it typically takes a good year. It could take longer. The Government Accounting Office did a study a couple of years ago and said that the average was 7 months, but we haven't seen that. It seems to us the average has to be a lot longer than that. But a year is not unusual. A year and a half or more is even sometimes.
Okay. While that's going on, is the person, perhaps they were in Iraq, perhaps in Afghanistan, they've seen combat and they're in part of a combat brigade somewhere. They're part of a squad that's going out and, you know, hunting up IEDs or looking for insurgents or whatever it is that they're doing on the job. Are they continuing to do that job, or once they've applied, are they kind of given a pass?
It's somewhere in between. Okay. The regulations say that as much as possible, they are supposed to accommodate the conscientious objector's beliefs. And so if there is some job that the conscientious objector, you know, would feel, you know, object to less, the regs say the command should try to accommodate them. But it's also up to the command. And the military mission is more important to the command than accommodating the conscientious objector's beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen a wide range of things. You know, we've seen people who go to their command and their command works with them and finds a way for them to continue their service and not, you know, be faced with a crisis of conscience. We've had other commands that, you know, deliberately give people orders that they know are going to be a problem for them. If they obey the command, they can say, you see, you're not really that serious as a conscientious objector. And if they disobey the command, they could be court-martialed or disciplined in some other way for refusing a command.
Mm.
And, you know, and everything in between. I should say those are the two extremes. But most people are somewhere in between. There's some degree of accommodation, but at some point they're up against the wall and they really have a struggle with, what should I do here?
How many people file for conscientious objector status in the military, and what percentage of those, once it goes up through the paperwork ranks to the top, are approved and allowed out?
Nobody knows how many apply, and that's because of the way the military keeps records. We do know that probably 100 or more a year make it to the top level for a decision, and approximately half of those get approved. But a lot of the folks like what we were just talking about. Okay, you get an order to do something, and you refuse it, then you get court-martialed, you go to jail, you get kicked out for something else, and you're not even counted as a conscientious objector in the official statistics.
So you end up...
really knows exactly the full number, but I can tell you that our office talks to people. I mean, we get calls every week. We get several calls, and it seems like we're getting an increase in calls recently. Let's see. I've been out of the office for a couple of weeks, but the week before I left, I read 4 new conscientious objector claims, people that had come to us for help as we're working with them as they're going through the process. And right now, new cases waiting for me when I got back yesterday, there's about 6 or 7. So and that's just our office, so we're not the only ones who are, you know, getting calls from these folks and helping them. So I don't think there's any way to know for sure what the total number is.
This is the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris talking with Bill Galvin of the GI Rights Hotline about conscientious objectors. I've got to take a break, and then we're going to come back a little bit and talk about what Don't Ask, Don't Tell is doing to the number of people who may be asking to get out of the military, and many of whom are claiming, or at least some of whom are claiming, that they are conscientious objectors, and we'll get into why when we come back in just a moment here on the Big 550 KTRS. This is the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris, filling in for John Brown and talking with Bill Galvin of the GI Rights Hotline, an organization that helps soldiers who feel like they just can't stay in the military because they've been exposed to war and can't fight it anymore, or don't want to have to go off to war for whatever reason. He's been helping people out since the days when we had a draft, which of course ended when the Vietnam era ended in the mid-1970s, but we still have people in an all-volunteer force who want out. And some of those who want out, surprisingly, are people who are in the military who have no objection to war, but instead have objection to homosexuals in the military. The House of Representatives voted on May 27th to allow the repeal of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. President Obama says he supports it. Probably not going to happen this year because the Pentagon is in the process of studying the effects of allowing openly gay service members. And until they release a report and the Defense Secretary and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the President all certify that repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell won't harm military effectiveness, nothing is going to change. But even with the prospect of it changing, Bill, are there really members of our military who say, I don't want to serve alongside an openly gay member of the armed forces?
Well, we have had a couple of calls from such people, yes.
And they want conscientious objector status? Does that even qualify?
Well, you know, we had to think about this when it first came because, you know, we like to be fair to everybody. And, you know, and what they were trying to say is because of my conscience or my religious beliefs, I think homosexuality is wrong or an abomination, and so I can't really be a part of a military and serve next to somebody like that. And we really, since the law says, you know, if you know, you can get, the law says that a conscientious objector is someone who, because of their religious, moral, or ethical beliefs, cannot in good conscience participate in war, you know, then that's what qualifies as a conscientious objector, and that's what, you know, is grounds for getting out. So then we had to think about this. Well, does this qualify? It doesn't seem to qualify based on our understanding of the law, but we certainly did want to think about it some and consider whether that might qualify. Part of the other thing that you have to show to be a conscientious objector is that you have to show that you have changed. They refer to this as a moment of crystallization. And earlier when I was given the example of, you know, looking down the barrel of a rifle at a live human being or even killing somebody, that is often cited by people in combat as their moment of crystallization. So in a case like this, well, what's your moment of crystallization? Well, it's not that you really changed, it's that the laws may be changing. So we think probably this doesn't qualify.
If it did qualify, wouldn't we have a slippery slope here? In fact, a slippery slope that goes back 6 decades to when Harry Truman decided to integrate the military? Could there have been people then? Maybe there were. In fact, I'm 100% sure there were white soldiers who refused to serve alongside black soldiers at the time. Would it have been unthinkable then to say to that white guy, okay, you don't want to serve next to the black guy? You can go.
Well, I think that's exactly the same issue now. Yeah, and and we'd be happy to help folks get out of the military for any legitimate reason. But as far as we can tell, this doesn't seem like a legitimate reason.
You've come to the conclusion that these guys don't qualify under the CO rules.
They don't qualify under the CO law. It's possible they have some other grounds for discharge, and if they did, we'd do what we could to help them. But I think being against gays or feeling that homosexuality is wrong, as far as we can tell, is not legitimate grounds for getting out of the military.
Yeah, I guess the same parallel would be when women were put into increased roles in the military. A guy couldn't say, I don't want to serve next to her. Let me out.
Well, and I'm sure there probably were such people. But I think you're right. I'm sure back in the 40s there were when the military was integrated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the people who are trying to get out, not for homophobic reasons, but for war-aphobic reasons. Mm-hmm. Do they tend to be people who have been serving for a short time and are perhaps on their first tour of duty, and they've seen battle for the first time, or maybe it's in the first month of their deployment there? Or are they some who have, because of whatever military policy, been forced to go back again and again and have just gotten fed up with it?
We've seen a wide range, okay, of folks. I mean, I would say probably more of them are younger and maybe in their first term of service. But I think probably, when I think about it, it's often people who have been, who are now back and were facing the prospect of going again, and now that they are have seen it firsthand, and they can reflect on it. They say, that's really wrong, and I don't think I can do it.
Someone who's seen the horrors of war and does not want to be exposed to it anymore, it's stuck in their mind, and it's come home with them, but they don't want to have to go there again.
And they say, I'm not going to go back. Yeah. I mean, that's not all. I mean, that's not the only thing. I mean, like I say, there are people whose conscience gets, crystallized while they're in training. There are people, actually one of the best conscientious objector claims I ever read was a woman who was stationed in Japan, and she was a Chinese linguist, so she was not likely to ever see any combat that anyone could foresee. And she visited the memorial site in Hiroshima, and it just shook her to her core, where she realized what she was a part of and what it was capable of. And that was her moment of crystallization. So there's a wide range of things that prick people's conscience. But I would say these days, being in combat seems to be the major one.
Was she released?
Yes, she was. She got an honorable discharge.
Well, that leads to the next question. What happens when somebody qualifies for conscientious objector status and the military says, okay, we believe that you are a CO and we're going to let you go? What happens to that person?
Well, the norm is they get an honorable discharge unless there's something else in their service record that would be, not honorable.
Yep.
Okay, you can't avoid a bad discharge by being a conscientious objector if you're going to get one anyway.
Right.
But under the law, there is nothing unhonorable about being a conscientious objector. So most COs who get out do get an honorable discharge, and that means they do qualify for whatever benefits they may have earned.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they get out early, they may not have been in long enough to earn too many benefits.
Yeah.
Because a lot of benefits are based on how long you served.
Yeah, if you're in for 6 months of a boot camp and a couple of months with boots on the ground in Afghanistan, you're not going to be on the Uncle Sam payroll forever.
No.
Okay, so does it follow them home in any other way? I mean, does anybody at home know that they were in the military and got out as a conscientious objector? How does that work?
It won't be overtly said on your discharge papers, uh-huh. Although there is some kind of coding, and there's certainly military records. And if you're applying for a job, for example, you usually sign some kind of permission for people to look into your background. So anybody who you know, would want to, could look into your record and find out, you know, why you got out of the military.
Have you had people who you've counseled who have had that used against them?
I can't think of anybody offhand.
Well, that's good.
In fact, many of the people who come out as conscientious objectors go on and talk about it. It becomes an important part of it. You know, you're changed by this. You know, once you've been into the heart of war and you've come to the conclusion that it's morally wrong and you can't do it, then once you go through this process and get out, a lot of them then feel a moral obligation to continue to spread the word and make sure other folks who might be thinking about joining the military understand what they're really getting into. Many of them go on and write books or go on speaking tours to basically say, look, I'm a soldier. I was a soldier. I was there, and this is wrong, and we need to change our policies.
Now, I've never served in the military. Have you, Bill?
I have not, no.
Okay. I can hear people listening to us, guys who've never served, never worn the uniform, saying, how can these people in an all-volunteer force really not understand? I mean, at the beginning, you talked about what the recruiters tell them about getting money for college and all that sort of stuff. But especially now, at a time when we've been at war in Afghanistan for nearly 9 years and we've been at war in Iraq for over 7 years, and we've had story after story after story from those who've returned home from that war and talked about their experiences, how can young men and women not know what they're getting into and be that surprised when they encounter the realities of modern warfare? What would you say to them?
To some degree, I agree with them. It's like, you know, why aren't people paying more attention? But I also think, recruiters are good. They are salespeople. I mean, I was once at a workshop with a recruiter who said, I could deflect people's attention from war in my sleep. You get really good at doing that.
Hmm.
But the other thing is you have to keep in mind that the way things are promised in the military, you don't just join the Army. Okay, you join with a specific, what they call it, MOS, a military occupational specialty, a specific job. And so they say, oh, well, you're going to be a computer specialist, so you're not going to be in combat. You're going to be working on computers, you know, or you're joining, the Ohio National Guard. You're not going to be going into combat. You're going to be here in case a tornado hits, you know, Ohio, or if the Ohio River floods or something like that, being providing relief to people. In fact, I got a call just last week from a guy who was in that very dilemma, and he said, he's actually facing possible deployment. He actually was a Marine. He got out and joined the National Guard, and he said, you know, I wanted to help my community. I think he was in Iowa. You know, we had floods here in Wichita Falls. I thought this would be a good way to serve the community. I could be here, could be called up, provide relief if that happened, and now I'm being sent off to Iraq or Afghanistan. This is a guy who'd been in, you know.
Yeah.
But when he's talking to the recruiter and thinking about his options, it doesn't sound like that's what you're joining.
If you're interested in getting more details on the GI Rights Hotline, which Bill works for, you can go to GIRightsHotline.org or call the toll-free number 877-447-4487. The call, the service, both free and confidential. Bill, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bill Galvin of the GI Rights Hotline, here on the Big 550 KTRS.